to the parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. It'd be paradise to put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard my screen door slam. A big yellow bulldozer took away the house and land. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. Be paradise to put up a parking lot. Be paradise to put up a parking lot. Be paradise to put up a parking lot. Be paradise to put up a parking lot.
This is Zecatopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and this week we hope you can take a bit of a breather.
Our guest is Dallas Hartwig, a functional medicine practitioner and physical therapist who has a book called The Four Season Solution.
He advocates following the seasons, as did our ancestors. Now, mostly post-COVID, we are in danger of being more disconnected from the natural world than ever. And Dallas will tell us how to get back on track.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico's Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round Wednesday morning in Chico at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday year-round at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, and a seasonal market Tuesday mornings in Paradise. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
To get us in a proper frame of mind for this interview, we'll get calm with a bit of J.S. Bach's Air on a G-String. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guest on the phone is Dallas Hartwig, author of a new book titled The Four Season Solution, the groundbreaking new plan for feeling better, living well, and powering down our always-on lives. It's published by Atria Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster.
Dallas Hartwig is a functional medicine practitioner and physical therapist. He has authored books describing healthier living, especially through food choices. He's also the co-host of the Living Experiment podcast and the author of an email newsletter on healthy living. He's been featured in media such as Today, Good Morning America, The Dr. Oz Show, The View, and more. And we're happy to welcome him to Ecotopia.
Let's, Dallas, start with your personal history, as described in the introduction to your book. Where did you spend your early life, your first 5 years or so?
Yeah, I had a fairly unconventional childhood. My parents were very pragmatic, kind of countercultural young adults in the mid-70s, and they left Greater Toronto in Ontario, Canada, and moved to a very small township in eastern Ontario and bought 100 acres, which happened to have a small cabin on it that was totally run down. And they repaired the cabin, and that's essentially where I lived till we were till I was five. And they had no electricity, no running water, and we were very much homesteaders. We cut our own wood, we grew our own food, and that experience fundamentally shaped the way I was connected to the natural rhythms of the earth. Mm-hmm. And later in my adolescence and my young adulthood, I completely abandoned that and became much more conventional in my way of living, and to great cost. And in my 30s, really started to re-examine that. And that was really the that examination process and my own self-experimentation was really what gave birth to this book.
Mm-hmm. Did you have nostalgia for the days in the cabin?
For sure. I mean, I think there was part of it was nostalgia just because it was my own childhood. But there was also a deep sense of calm and peace and groundedness that as my world got bigger and busier and faster paced, there definitely was this yearning for a solidity and a groundedness and a connection to the earth that I completely lost in the years that I was flying all over the place for speaking events and this and that. And so the yearning for connection to the earth and to kind of the natural rhythms of nature itself, I think is something that a lot of us have started to identify, but we haven't quite known how to meet that unmet need.
Mm-hmm. So when you first began writing, you focused on food, but you have taken a much broader view now. What is the central thesis of this book?
Well, the central thesis of the four-season solution really is that we have left behind the natural rhythms to great cost, to great detriment. And, you know, I use the four seasons of the year as sort of symbolic phases for different timelines. And, you know, that does include the annual seasons of spring, summer, fall, and winter. But it also includes time of day variations, and also on the longer timeline, the seasons of our lives, because there are different behavioral and emotional characteristics of these different timelines, but they all follow this very repetitive, almost a fractal pattern on different timelines, and I find that fascinating. And so part of what I wrote into the book was my observations and wisdoms about the different aspects and experiences of these different timelines, starting with health. I mean, I write about food and movement and sleep and the meaningful connections that are so important to us as humans. But those pieces in an integrated system really only matter if they actually provide us with the opportunity to live a much richer, more vibrant life.
Mm-hmm. So can you say something about the rhythms of expansion and contraction and how that relates to the seasons?
Certainly. So the simplest, the kind of lowest common denominator in terms of the rhythm that I write about in the book is this pattern of expansion and contraction, as you mentioned. And, you know, that is true across the course of a day. You know, in the morning we wake up, our world is quite small. We're at home. We're in our bedroom. We're with people we love and know and trust. And then our world physically expands. We go out into the world to go to work, to go to school, to travel. And then at the end of the day, we come home to a place that is small again. So there is this expansion contraction across the course of a day. It happens across the course of a year. Spring and summer are expansive modes of being that are exploratory and exciting and energizing. And fall and winter are much more restorative and calming and grounding. And so that sensation of coming home and being grateful. And that expansion contraction cycle occurs on biological levels, on emotional levels, and all of these different levels. And I think that we can really use that pattern to help us inform the way we move through the world so that we can move in ways that feel more deeply natural and intuitive. And the more intuitive they are, the less effortful they feel, the less resistance we feel in our lives. And I think what a lot of us are feeling in this modern world is so much resistance and effort just to get through each day and month and year and decade. Mm-hmm. And I argue that reestablishing familiarity and closeness with those natural rhythms will help us feel as if we are moving with less effort.
So how did we get stuck? So as I understand it, you're seeing that we're stuck in kind of unnatural rhythms right now. And so what does that look like, and how do we get stuck there?
Yeah, so I'll take a brief step, and we'll do a very, very brief history lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, for most of human history, for about 2.5 million years, we lived primarily as hunter-gatherers. We were, we lived in egalitarian tribal groups, and we roamed around, and we followed the food as the food itself migrated and flowered. And that gave us the opportunity to be very flexible. We are, sort of dietarily speaking, very omnivorous and very adaptable. And once we started growing our own food in agriculture 10 or 12,000 years ago, and then as we started settling down and urbanizing and becoming more permanent, and we established ownership societies, and we established civilization as a broad thing, what happened is we became more and more divorced from the natural world, from the rhythms. And the whole purpose of agriculture was to stabilize our food supply so that we weren't beholden to the different fruiting seasons of different vegetations and the migration of the animals that we might have hunted or foraged for. And so that afforded us stability, but at the cost of disconnection. Mm-hmm. And that idea follows us all the way through the rest of civilization, through the Industrial Revolution, through the technological and digital age. And we are so disconnected from the natural rhythms that are not just sort of out there in nature, in the parks, in the forest, but they're in us. And so we've gotten ourselves kind of stuck in this mode of perpetual expansion, because spring and summer are those modes of expansion, but they're only half of that cycle. And so I write about this concept of chronic summer as being stuck in the mode, both sort of civilizationally and also personally, being stuck in the mode of chronic expansion. And the sensation of summertime is of hard work, productivity, success, the drive to get more, to create more, to consume more, to accumulate more. And it's really the foundation of consumer society. And that's what the whole world is hurtling towards, or hurtling into, deeper into. And so that concept of being stuck, we are stuck in this mode of perpetual expansion. And I argue that it is the imbalance in our expansion-contraction cycle that is at the core of so much of our unhappiness, our dis-ease, and our chronic disease, to be more specific. So the stuckness is a product of an imbalanced system.
So what is supposed to happen during times of contraction? And that's winter, I assume, and nighttime. Mm-hmm. How what would that balance bring us?
Right. So fall and winter, you're exactly right. Fall and winter are the other half, the contractive phases. So summer is the most expanded, winter is the most contracted, and spring and fall are sort of transitionary phases, going in either in the direction of expansion with spring or contraction with fall. And fall, if you think about the North American tradition of Thanksgiving, fall is the sensation of slowing down, of coming home, of harvest, of gratitude, of abundance, of generosity, of reconnection, of bringing people close who matter most to you. And that's the sensation of, that's sort of the Thanksgiving spirit, is of harvest and generosity and of gratitude. And that's something that I think on many different levels we really lack in our society these days. And so I write about this idea of just taking your foot off the gas going into the fall of each year, because it's the easiest to really feel in your mind as you're reading and as you're thinking about this. But it's also true of the sort of afternoon into the evening of each day, which is effectively, you know, analogous to the fall. It's also true of the first half of the second half of our lives, kind of what I write about the autumn of our lives, starting somewhere in our mid to late 40s. We should be thinking about slowing down, anticipating the future, what our legacy is, those types of things as we're getting towards middle age. But we don't really do that in this world. We tend to kind of put the pedal to the metal and try to squeeze out the maximum promotions and earnings and accumulation of wealth. And ultimately that comes on the back of extraction of resources from not only the natural world, but also from other humans. And so there's a tremendous externalized cost there when we try to maximize the consumptive component of that summer of our lives. And we stretch that well beyond the, 45 to 50 range. And we push that way into, kind of common retirement age of around 65. And then we get to 65 exhausted and hollowed out and not really sure what we were doing all of those years. And one of the most common regrets of people on their deathbed is that they spent so much time working and accumulating wealth and not enough time deeply connecting with people that mattered to them. So that's the opportunity for us to think differently as we go into those later years.
So I can see that this is broadly metaphorical, and I'm wondering how you think of it geographically. Are there different kind of models of this for, say, someone who lives on the equator and someone who lives near the poles? And how do you use the metaphor?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it is a metaphor, and it's also a very specific set of guidelines, because really what this is my own observations about what goes on with the human physiology at different times of the day and year and lifetime. And my background, my undergraduate degree is in anatomy and physiology, so I come at this from very much from a mechanistic and biological perspective. And so it is literal in the sense that our biology is entrained to the light dark cycle, to the different foods that we eat, to the different types of physical activity that we do or don't do, and to the way that we have social connections with other people, because of course we are deeply social creatures. And so it's literal and it's metaphorical. And the literal component means that so much of our circadian biology, so much of our the rhythms that are ingrained into our different body systems, from digestion to detoxification to the formation of neurotransmitters and hormones, all run on a circadian rhythm, which is entrained, which is anchored to the cycle of light and dark. And so that, of course, varies dramatically based on where you are relative to the equator. If you're at the equator, there's not a great deal of variation seasonally in terms of the amount of light and dark. And the farther north and south you go from the equator, the greater the extreme. So the amplitude, the amount of variation seasonally is proportionate to how far north and south you are of the equator proportionally. So people in northern Canada or northern Europe would have a much wider amplitude of variation, a much greater variation in their behaviors around food and movement and sleep and social connection than somebody who was living at or near the equator. Does that make sense?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Would that also override the inherited patterns that we have from ancient history?
Yeah, so yes and no. Obviously, you know, we have genetic influences, and what mm-hmm. we know is that different people groups that have spent many thousands of years in different parts of the world have adapted to their local environments and passed those genes along to their offspring. However, humans across the board have far more similarities than differences.
Okay.
So it's my premise that the inputs from our local environment, and especially true for the light and dark cycle, are a much larger influence than our genetic or racial or ethnic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So the ideal situation would be that our genetic backgrounds perfectly match our geographical locations, which perfectly match what's going on in the natural world in that area, and everything is perfectly synced up. But in the absence of that, with everyone moving all around and having many different kind of genetic variations, the single most important factor is what's going on in your local environment, wherever you happen to live.
We're both former academics, so we've spent our lives in tune with the school year. I'm thinking about how much that is in opposition to what you're talking about. We get geared up early September, get the syllabi set, the students show up. This would be same for kids in school as well. And then throw in the excitement of the holiday season. Thanksgiving may or may not be restful, but we've got the holiday season, we've got the football season, the basketball season, March Madness,
right.
All of that designed to rev us up.
Well, and I think that you bring out a really good point that so much of our society is built on mismatches. Yeah. So we have behavioral mismatches between what our deep urges, our yearnings are for, and what we have sort of entrained or habituated ourselves to do. And the holiday season is a great example, and I'll include New Year's resolutions in there and comment on that in a moment.
Yes, yes.
But the concept of the holiday season, of course, has changed a lot over the decades and centuries. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that decades and centuries ago, there was a lot of quietude and drawing close to the people that matter most to you, and generosity and connection. And you think about the sort of stereotypical, perhaps Northern European or North American scene of a family at home around the fireplace, exchanging perhaps Christmas gifts. And it's a very small, quiet, intimate affair. And the world as it goes now, with families strewn all over the place and compulsive and perceived necessary shopping in the sort of very consumerist sense, and the financial stress of spending money to buy gifts that people don't even necessarily want or need, that no longer echoes that same familiar sentiment of intimacy and closeness and generosity and connection. And so it's no wonder that we feel compelled, or we feel a social obligation, to go to holiday parties and to do all this stuff. But it's actually at odds with our biology, because in the fall and into the winter, we actually have this urge to slow down and quiet ourselves and rest and almost go into a sort of semi-hibernative state where we're not outside all the time and running to and fro, in a very, very frantic way. So New Year's resolutions, similarly, there's nothing biologically relevant about the 1st of January. And all of the biological and psychological and emotional experiences that we have operate on these natural expansion and contraction rhythms. So actually, the dead of winter in the Northern Hemisphere around January is the least opportune time to embark on a new journey, because actually, the dead of winter is when you should be maximally contracted. So I argue that the dreaming for the future that happens in the fall, and especially the winter, should be a time for restoring ourselves from the preceding summer and fall, and also dreaming of the future, so that when the spring comes around, we have that energy of more light and more warmth, and just the sort of titillation of spring and all of the neurochemical influences that go with that, we are then able to naturally, intuitively, and spontaneously charge out into the world and start new things in the spring. So I think that we should be discarding New Year's resolutions as a concept. And if we want to keep it as a New Year resolution, actually that year should start sometime in March in the Northern Hemisphere. So that, because that's what we do anyway. We start a new exercise program. We go back and we start running, or we clean out the garage, we put the garden in. And we do that relatively spontaneously, as opposed to forcing ourselves to start a new exercise routine on January 1st that by January 10th has probably stopped.
You gave us a brief history a few minutes ago to kind of start this out. And I'm wondering if you think there is a golden age of human beings living more naturally.
That's a great question. I do, and I've often been accused of being somewhat idealizing about our hunter-gatherer past. And actually, just happenstance, happened to be rereading Daniel Quinn's book, Beyond Civilization, right now. I was reading it just a couple hours ago. And my perspective very much aligned with his perspective, where the world as it existed before civilization, while not being idyllic or peaceful or effortless, certainly gave those more kind of primitive hunter-gatherer societies a lot more time for leisure, a lot more time for collaboration and communication and play. And yes, they did not have electricity. They did not have, you know, smartphones. They did not have international transportation in airplanes. But I think in terms of the sense of belonging, because in the Four Season Solution, I write up this concept of the Great Separation. And the Great Separation started when we started to think of ourselves as above and separate from nature. And that happened somewhere back tens of thousands of years ago with the Cognitive Revolution. And we started to think of ourselves as different and better than all of the other creatures and the earth itself. So is that, I'm not calling for us to abandon electricity and civilization and all of that, but I think we could learn a lot from the way that egalitarian societies are structured, because as soon as we start introducing hierarchy and competition and consumption as primary values, we very quickly lock ourselves into a societal pattern of perpetual expansion, which I don't believe is actually something that can really continue. I think if we look around the world right now, what we see is the cost of that ethos stretched out over thousands of years.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Dallas Hardwick, who is the author of The Four Season Solution. Dallas, in talking about the formation of the Four Season Solution, you give some credit to Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that hierarchy and then how that shaped your thinking about the four seasons.
Certainly. So Maslow's hierarchy of needs is incredibly influential in my work. And I'll summarize it as a model for understanding many different human needs. And the most basic of it would be things like food and shelter and sleep. And much of consumer society is based on meeting those needs or proxies for those needs. But there are also kind of more larger and esoteric needs, things like belonging and contribution to something larger than oneself. And originally, Maslow wrote about self-actualization as sort of the pinnacle of human self-evolution or self-advancement. And that's kind of been evolved and updated in recent decades to include this sense of transcendence of oneself and contribution to something greater than oneself. So this is where a lot of religious and spiritual practices come in, and this contribution to a legacy, to a future, to a larger global community. And that's what gives us, so many of us, a sense of purpose. So Maslow's work informs my perspective significantly, because the Four Season Solution talks about food and movement and sleep and connection, but notably those features that sort of move in oscillatory patterns in our daily lives, or at least should move in oscillatory patterns in our daily lives, are meeting those fairly foundational, most basic needs. And my premise is that when we are able to put less effort and emotional bandwidth and willpower into the most basic needs, what happens is this beautiful, natural sort of flourishing and flowering and ascendance of people spontaneously. And we are interested in arts and culture and learning and expansion in a sort of psychological and emotional sense. And most often over the course of time, that leads us spontaneously to ask ourselves, what can I give to the world? What can I give back? How can I give to something larger than myself? So it is the experience of fear and scarcity, the sensation of scarcity, not actual literal scarcity, but the sensation of scarcity that leaves us feeling like we need to accumulate more for ourselves and not be so generous with people around us. And so then to go back to your original question, the premise here is that when people can use the Four Seasons Solution as a way to foster that effortless, intuitive way of living, they open doors to much richer and more interesting and sort of larger ways of being in the world. And I think that's what inspires me most about Maslow's work.
Can we talk a little bit more about those four areas, sleep, food, movement, and connection? What we're trying to move toward in balance and how we've gotten it wrong?
Sure. I'll kind of take those in order. You know, most people who have read previous works of mine are familiar with my work on food. My first book was actually called It Starts With Food. And the premise there was that what we eat is the single largest influence on our overall health and happiness. And I toy with the idea in the Four Seasons Solution of replacing that and actually saying it starts with sleep, it starts with the light-dark cycle, because the presence or absence of light so significantly influences our biology in ways that I and many other researchers didn't previously recognize. And that's becoming much more well understood in recent years and decades. But from a food standpoint, this is kind of connecting back to your question on geography. From a food standpoint, the simplest way to think about eating healthfully is to eat a mix of naturally raised, naturally fed plants and animals that are available to you locally and seasonally. So it means eating foods that are available at the farmer's market or out of your own garden. And I say a mix of plants and animals because all human species, as far back as we know, have been opportunistic omnivores. We eat seafood or meat or eggs or whatever is available to us in addition to the wide variety of nutrient-dense plants. So vegetables and fruit and nuts and seeds are all part of a healthy diet, and most of the nutritional research bears that out. So the oscillation, the cycle that goes on in terms of our diets, should be informed by what's happening in our geographical area. And the easiest way to do that is by shopping at the farmer's market and out of your own garden, ideally. So it doesn't have to be incredibly complicated. I think one of the strengths of this this model is that so many of the sort of shortcuts or heuristics in the book are very easy to remember because they're just, you look outside and that's what happens. And, you know, if I talk about the light and dark cycle, it was a similar way of understanding it, where our cycle of exposure to light and then the absence of light, darkness, should be informed by what's going on outside. So we obviously have artificial light, we use electricity, all of that's totally fine. But when we get into a pattern of living where we use artificial light and thus control of our kind of our light dark cycle, and we totally skip and bypass the presence of more light in the summertime and less light in the wintertime, we not only sort of flatten that oscillation that would occur seasonally, but we also extend our exposure to light and blunt our exposure to darkness dramatically, because we basically behave as if it's summertime with lots of light, from early morning till late in the evening, and we behave like it's summertime year round. And that not only does it inhibit our deep restorative sleep, but there's also a whole, what I call a darkness physiology that changes when we actually step away from either the sunshine during the day or the artificial light after darkness, after sunset. And the relative absence of darkness is also a problem, not just the reduction in sleep. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because there are a lot of people talking about, avoiding exposure to blue light after dark, getting more sleep, some of these kinds of ideas. But I think really the larger umbrella concept there is understanding that more time spent in darkness, more like what happens outside, is actually a really important idea.
So does that mean that in the winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, we should be sleeping a lot more than we do in the summer? It's not like 8 hours of sleep a night, but it changes according to season?
Exactly. It does. And, we think about 8 hours as sort of a magical number. I think that's a decent average. For me, what ends up happening often in the summertime is somewhat less than 8 hours, because I'm getting, the light is waking me up early, and, the presence of light at 9 p.m., it makes it hard to kind of wind down and get to bed, so I'm up later. But what that does also mean is that in the winter, United States, and so in the Northern Hemisphere, we have the sun going down much earlier, and that's the cue for me to start slowing down and letting my inside, my home lighting situation, look a lot more like outside. So it doesn't mean I have to turn all the lights out, but it does mean that I dramatically dim the lights much, much earlier, sometimes as early as 6 or 7 p.m., so that it looks and feels more like fireside or candlelight, and rather than kind of bright fluorescent or LED lights, which contain a lot more of the blue wavelength. And those blue wavelengths are a problem because they send the message to our brain, we should be alert. It's basically the message that there's blue sky at midday. And that's a very alerting effect. And that doesn't set us up for deep restorative sleep that evening.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about movement. I was intrigued. You talk about we could learn from the caveman workout. And we know from the book that you were very vigorous and active and have shifted your movement and your exercise patterns since developing the Four Seasons model.
Yeah, for sure. The concept with movement, also much like with light and with food, follows and is informed by what's going on outside. So in the Northern Hemisphere, in the wintertime, I do a lot less overall general movement. So there's a lot less sort of duration and volume of movement. And in the summertime, it means that there's a ton of time outside in general movement, whether it is hiking and backpacking or working in my garden or swimming at the lake or playing at the park with my son. Summertime is the time for being out and expanding and lots of movement. And that is lots of kind of general movement at a relatively low intensity. So it is the long runs, long bike rides, swimming, general activity. And in the winter, there's sort of an inversion of that where it becomes much more short and much more intense. And the anchor throughout that across the course of the year is of maintaining strength through functional movements like lifting and carrying things. So the physical capacity, the skeletal and muscular structures of my body stay strong and capable. And like many people who were athletic, I played high-level volleyball through most of my 20s. And in my 20s, the lots of activity at high intensity, and lots of competition was something that I could sort of tolerate and maintain, but it came at a cost. And the longer I did that at an excessive kind of amount, the more the physical cost to my body really started to add up. So I'm now in my early 40s, and I'm having this experience of recognizing that I want to maintain strength and physical capacity as I go into the fall of my life. Mm-hmm. So in the same sense as the fall of each year would be slowing down and less general activity, and less, you know, kind of less pushing myself so hard in that very summertime kind of way, I'm feeling more content and at ease now to maintain good functional strength in my body, to maintain bone density, to maintain muscle mass, but not necessarily requiring me to push so hard to do so. And I anticipate going into even later years, maintaining that strength and capacity will be continued to be a core value, a core feature, much like it is going into the fall and winter of each year. We don't become sedentary each winter. We simply maintain our physical capacity with much shorter and more intense physical activity.
I found your comment that we should become exercise generalists very helpful in describing that concept.
Certainly.
And as well as your observation that the caveman workout did include a lot of lifting, moving around, but occasional dashing at high speed when a lion was in the neighborhood. So it was not...
Undoubtedly. Yeah, and I think the key there is that it's occasional, you know, and I think what we have made the mistake of doing in this modern world is through industrialization, we have mechanized so much of our lives so that we can, many of us, a large percentage of the population, can be almost completely sedentary for the vast majority of the day. We, you know, we walk a few meters to the car to drive to the office or drive to school. And then we take the escalator into the office, and then we sit at our desk and we do whatever we do. And so there's this extraordinary amount of time where we are physically inactive. And then because we recognize intellectually that exercise is important, we go to the gym or we go to a class or we get on our bike and we ride at relatively high intensity for 30 or 40 or 50, you know, an hour for an extended period of time. And what I'm arguing for is more bouts of more useful real world movement throughout the course of the day. And that can be something as simple as carrying your groceries a few blocks to your car instead of driving around in the parking lot for several minutes to find the closest possible parking spot. So it is the purposeful inclusion of real life movements. And there's this also the sense, you know, if you think about it, and here I live in Salt Lake City, and there's a beautiful farmers market that runs here each summer. And I really enjoy the sensation of parking several blocks away from the farmer's market and walking over and taking my reusable bags with me and filling them with food and carrying them back in my hands to my car, even if I ultimately do drive home. But there is this sort of sensation that feels a little bit like foraging. There's a little more of a connection to my food and to where it comes from, and I really appreciate that.
Connectivity, that is feels like a really big one to me. I can see how we can adjust the others pretty easily, but how do we connect? How do we get those kinds of connections that are deep and not trivial? And
yeah, that's such a great question, and the answer here kind of follows the template of many of my other answers, which points to where we went awry with our culture, with our civilization, is this perpetual focus on summer feelings. And summertime is expansion and novelty and exploration. And summer type social occasions would look like neighborhood block parties and big barbecues and having friends bring friends over to meet new people. And so it's a very expansive mode, but as such is also a really relatively superficial mode. And so all of social media exists in the summertime space. It exists in the space of very small, very superficial interactions with a large number of people. And that is antithetical to the experience of being present and deeply and intimately connected with other people. And so just like we've done with food and movement and sleep, we've also, with human connection, got stuck in this chronic summer mode. So my call then is not to forsake social media or forsake large social events, but to recognize that those are perfectly appropriate during the middle of the day, during the middle of the year in the summertime, and during the kind of middle of our lives, that mode where you're maximally expanded. But we also need to recognize the need for quietude and solitude and contraction and the principle I write into the book about anchor connections is one where we recognize that there are static pieces of our lives as well as oscillatory pieces. And just like there has been for all of human history, we humans really need a handful of people in our inner circle that we know and trust and who love us and we feel cared for and that we belong to. And that's what's been lost so much in modern society, because we are busy, we are overstimulated, we are focusing too much on social media to be able to be present to the people right there in front of us. So my offering is to let go of the chronic summer mode of socializing, to look up from your phone, to look away from the TV or computer screen, and look at the faces around you, and not just look at them and not just converse with them superficially, but also learn to be more emotionally vulnerable and present to and engage with them on a much deeper level. Because I think in general, when we look around the world, this epidemic of loneliness is not the same as being alone. And we can be very, very lonely in the presence of other people. So my suggestion then is to invest more time and energy in the people who are closest to us and most important to us, who in times like now, whose health we are most concerned about. I think that's a great indicator of who belongs in that inner circle. And I think that allows us then to both have, you know, big social events and social media presences, and also be really present and vulnerable with the people who matter most to us, because both of those things are aspects of a normal human's social life, so to speak. So it's not exclusion of one to have more of the other. It's a recognition that those two things occur in phases at different times of the day and year and lifetime.
As I read the chapter on connectivity, I thought a lot about the COVID-19 situation, which has put us under enormous stress. And obviously, our first concern has to be for the people who are sick, the people who've lost their jobs. But for a lot of us, sheltering in place gives us an opportunity to reconnect. We can talk over the back fence. And I'm sensing in our area a growing sense, much of it online, that it's time for us to get over the politics of hate, the amount of animosity that's been floating about in the United States over the past several years, and to reboot.
I love hearing that. I also feel that sensation personally and in kind of the air around me, so to speak. And I find that really encouraging. One of the suggestions I make in the book is this pivot out of a chronic summer mode of being into more of a fall mode of being, which is the early stages of contraction and connectivity and, you know, reconnection with people who matter and of gratitude and of generosity. And I think what I hear you're saying is that many of us are starting to realize with this sort of forced contraction, which is really what this shelter in place experience is like, is a forced contraction. And we're noticing the spontaneous desire to put aside differences and to be more generous and present to and connected with those around us. So I love hearing you say that, because that's so much an idea that's written right into the book.
Mm-hmm. You use the word anchors, and we just have a few minutes here, and I'm thinking about how we go about establishing new patterns. Can you talk about how anchors help us do that?
Sure. So much of the principles of the book are focused on rhythms and changes and cycles and oscillations. And what's notable about all those things is there is always a reference point. There is always a central hub or a pendulum swings from a fixed point. And so there are anchors, things that don't change across the course of those different timelines as well. So across the four domains, we have in food, it is the presence of nutrient-dense, whole food-based protein sources at each meal. So that's what we often do in Western or modern culture, is we leave a lot of our complete protein to the evening meal. So we eat this very, very large protein-rich meal. But from a hormone and satiety standpoint, from a neurotransmitter standpoint, and from an energetic standpoint, we actually do best with protein at each meal across the course of the day. From a movement standpoint, it is what I mentioned earlier, the regular inclusion of functional strength training, things like squats and deadlifts and presses and lunging and carrying things, the things where we pick up and move objects in our world, which could look like working in the garden and carrying groceries and those types of things, very real world activities. And those should be included across the course of all of the seasons as a constant. In the realm of sleep, really the anchors there are the presence of darkness. And not just, you know, when we are asleep with our eyes closed in our bedroom, but also getting our daily rhythms to look a little bit more like what's going on outside with the natural light, which means more time in really dim light and more time in relative darkness. And then actually making sure that our bedrooms when we're sleeping are actually completely dark, because that's one of the mistakes we often make is we have various electronic lights and light pollution in our bedrooms, and that doesn't allow us to get into that really deep restorative sleep. And in the realm of connection, as I mentioned, the anchor then is the presence of one or two or three or four or five really important people in our lives that we stay connected to and vulnerable with across the course of our year and across the course of our decades, the seasons of our lives, because we shouldn't be isolated at any point. We shouldn't feel alone. And if we do, that's the opportunity, the cue for us to really reach out to people and really reestablish that anchor, that solid point in our lives.
Our guest has been Dallas Hartwig. He is the author of The Four Seasons, the groundbreaking new plan for feeling better, living well, and powering down our always-on lives. We've only touched on the book published by Autria, and you can learn more about Dallas and his work at dallashartwig.com.
Thank you very much for both the book and the interview, Dallas. A pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Thank you.
Take care.
A little bit of Antonio Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, reflecting on our interview with Dallas Hartwig. So next week on Ecotopia, our guest will be Charles Withyun, a North State Chico activist who is deeply involved in helping the homeless people and seeking a solution to the ever-growing homeless crisis here in Chico. Coming up at 6 this evening, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. At 5:30, at 6:30, it's Radioactive with Ginger Nichols.
That's it for Ecotopia tonight. You can find us on KZFR, ecotopiakzfr.net, and you can contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us.
North State Give and Take. This is a show about nonprofits in the North State. Today is a pre-recorded interview with the Friends of Bidwell Park. Today, I want to welcome John Mers, who's been a friend of mine for quite a while, and he is with Friends of Bidwell Park.
Correct.
And so I'm going to let John kind of take off and tell us, you know, what does the Friends of Bidwell Park do? My God, Bidwell Park certainly needs friends, so I'm interested too. So go ahead, John.
Well, basically, we became a nonprofit organization back in 2003. Pretty much in response to a proposal to have the disc golf course established up on Highway 32. And that had originally been on Bureau of Land Management land, which then got transferred to the city of Chico. Became part of the park, part of that whole thing that happened actually a number of years ago when that south side was added to the park. That's not part of the original park lands. It was, again, purchased by the city subsequent to that.
Now, I just had one question. Now, sure. When you say park, most people picture what's right downtown and out to 5 Mile. But okay. You're talking about a much bigger...
That's a really good point. Now, yeah, Bidwell Park, you know, it's actually over 3,000 acres. Basically, the park is really, they say, upper park.